We're ready when you are, Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Judge Motz. Morning, Your Honors. Richard Simmons, counsel for Appellant Robert F. Anderson, Chapter 7 trustee for the estate of Susan Patricia Pfister. And with the court's permission, I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, a debtor must be just before he is generous. The trustee asked this court to reverse the district court in its entirety and to reinstate the judgment of the bankruptcy court for the following 4 reasons. Resulting trust for the benefit of the appellee is not proper in this case. The debtor transferred an undivided, full, one-half interest in her property on December 31, 2008 to the appellee. The bankruptcy court correctly determined that the transfer was constructively fraudulent.
Is it true under South Carolina law that when one person or one entity purchases property but is deeded in the name of the other, that a resulting trust, there's a presumption of a resulting trust?
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, did one entity pay for the property, and was it titled in the bankrupt's name?
Well, Your Honor, yes.
Is that correct?
Well, it is. There was no down, Judge Shedd, there was no down payment made.
I asked you that.
Correct.
Said the mortgage. One entity purchased the property, because I couldn't find that specifically in this record. Did Architectural Glass purchase the property? Who purchased the property?
Well, there was,
I mean, paid money for it.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the,
who was it under this record? I'm asking you.
That on May 10th of 2001, Architectural Glass took out a loan for $35,000.
Do you know from this record who paid the money for the property?
Architectural Glass.
Okay. And it was deeded in at least in part in the bankrupt's name, correct?
That's correct.
That creates a presumption of a resulting trust under South Carolina law. Is that correct?
It does, yes, Your Honor.
And so then you would have to rebut that presumption.
That's correct.
What is your strongest evidence to rebut that presumption?
Well, Your Honor, the actual intent of the parties may be rebutted by parole evidence.
I know all that. I said, what's your strongest evidence to rebut it?
Well, in this case, the bankruptcy court found, Your Honor, and they stated on joint appendix.
I didn't ask what they found. I'm asking you what the evidence in the record, the strongest evidence in the record to rebut that is what?
Well, the party's intent on the purchase date was that the debtor and her husband would both jointly own the property.
Well, that's the conclusion. What's the evidence of that?
Well, the evidence, Your Honor, would be that there is there was a plat that was put into Architectural Glass's name on January 19th.
Well, that's not evidence in your behalf.
Well, no, but it does go to show that on the purchase date, May 10th of 2001, there's a change in intent. And it's in the record, it's testimony, Your Honor, that the property was titled in the...
Let's do it this way. Rather than argue what intent is, let's talk about the operative facts.
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
And the facts that you would point to in this record, I'm not arguing with you, I'm just trying to get the record straight.
Yes, Your Honor.
What one would be that the property is actually deeded in her name?
That's correct.
But that doesn't rebut anything, does it? Because that's required under resulting trust, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so what other evidence is there?
Well, there's no definite, unequivocal, clear, and convincing proof that Architectural Glass wanted to own the property, because if it had wanted to own the property, it would have deeded the property into its own name, rather on the purchase date.
But the resulting trust is deeded in another person's name, correct?
Correct.
So the fact that it's deeded in her name, is that... That's not supportive of anything, is it?
Well, I would argue that there's no evidence in the record showing that at any point in the future did Architectural Glass actually want to own the property. It was the intent of the parties that they would use the property on the purchase date on May 10th of 2001, but it was not the intent that they would own the property.
But they don't have to show evidence to rebut the presumption. You have to show evidence to rebut the presumption. If there's no evidence, don't they win because the presumption is for a resulting trust?
But, Your Honor, there is evidence, and the bankruptcy court found as a finding of fact, and it wasn't plain error, that on the purchase date, the intent of the parties is what the court must assess. And on the purchase date, it was the intent, after receiving advice from the debtor and her husband's CPA, that the property for...
And what's the strongest underlying evidence for the bankruptcy court to reach that conclusion, then?
It's the testimony in the joint appendix, Your Honor, page...
Is that the CPA's advice?
It was. The debtor and the husband testified. The advice
of the CPA?
Yes, Your Honor.
CPA told them they needed to put it in their own names and have the company rent from them.
Yes, Your Honor. And that on the purchase date is what must be assessed, not before or after.
That's what they did on the purchase date.
Correct. And that's what rebuts the presumption of resulting trust. The district,
but doesn't that just go to who owns the title? I mean, who has the title in their name? That doesn't really go to ownership, does it?
Well, I think it does, Your Honor. It was titled in their name, and they treated this as, although the corporation didn't pay rent, the debtor and the husband still treated this as though it was the same scenario, and it was similar as the bankruptcy.
No, wait. What do you mean they treated it as the same scenario? They didn't, the corporation never paid rent.
Right. They never paid rent. They paid the mortgage, the title,
insurance.
They
paid for it as if it was their property.
Right. But they did not intend on the purchase date, which is what this court must assess, there's no agreement in the record.
Listen, that's what I'm going to take you back. Your evidence is that on the purchase date, it was deeded in the name of the bankrupt.
Correct.
And some evidence that the CPA said if you set it up this way, you can have these tax advantages.
Correct.
Is there anything that indicates the CPA says actual ownership of the property has to change hands? Or is it just if you title this way, I'm advising you, you can take advantage of the tax code?
I think it was likely the latter, Your Honor.
Now, I don't say it was likely. I'm just saying, is there any evidence that make that distinction? I can't find any.
I would agree. I don't have any evidence in the record, but the record does state, and if you look at Joint Appendix, page 1261, the question, why did you put your name on the deed? Why was individually your name and your husband's name? And the answer of the debtor on cross-examination was, I believe our CPA at the time recommended it for tax reasons.
Right, but that doesn't mean that the actual ownership was changed at all. It was just that on that date, the title reflected as if they owned it, correct?
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. I would think that...
Well, what evidence do you have that it's one or the other? What evidence is that the CPA said it's a requirement that you actually own the property rather than just title it that way?
Well, if that were the case, they would have titled it in the name of Architectural Glass. But
If the CPA says, title it this way, you can get tax advantages. That's not the same as saying shift ownership as reflected in the title, is it?
I think it is, Your Honor.
Based on what is it?
I think that based on...
Let me ask you this much. Based on anything in this record, can you make that statement?
Well, Your Honor, again,
Can you point to anything in the record that indicates, even if they were following the advice of the CPA, that advice entailed giving up ownership of the property rather than just titling it in some way?
Well, you have to look at the intent of the parties on the purchase date, and I know you're saying that.
I'm asking you what the evidence is on that date.
Well, I think the evidence on that date is the debtor's testimony and her husband's testimony that it was titled in their name, such that if you look at the scenario, if in fact the appellee had paid rent as was planned, that couldn't have happened if it was titled in its own name. They were going to take benefits on that purchase date.
That explains why you would title it differently, but I don't see how that necessarily reflects actual ownership.
I think the title and the ownership have a great correlation there.
But not in a resulting trust.
I think so, Your Honor.
No, they don't in a resulting trust. It's just the opposite, that the title doesn't reflect ownership.
I understand what you're saying, and then we have to, is the trustee's position then to rebut that, and you rebut that by looking at the party's actual intent on the purchase date.
Right.
And it wasn't...
The bankruptcy court had a trial?
They did, yes, Your Honor.
How long did it last?
2 days, Your Honor.
How many witnesses testified?
There were, I believe, 6 witnesses, Your Honor.
And then the bankruptcy court made findings of fact and conclusions of law?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, sir. And
you say that we need to rely on the findings of fact because they're not clearly erroneous.
That's correct, Your Honor. The evidence is not...
And you say the other side has to show their clear error.
Correct, which is a very high burden to meet as to facts. This isn't a de novo review.
And the district court didn't make any findings of fact.
The district court adopted, in part, the bankruptcy court's findings of fact, including...
But the district court didn't make any findings of fact.
Well, Well, it didn't make any additional.
It wasn't entitled to make any findings of fact because it didn't have a trial.
Correct.
It was acting as we are. It was an appellate court.
Correct, Your Honor. And so it also recognized that it would be plain error. The standard is plain error when you're assessing the facts as found by the trial court. And so in
plain error or clear error?
Well, it would be clear error, Your Honor.
I think it would be clear error.
And so
plain error has another meaning in this up here. We hear a lot about that too.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And in applying the clear error standard, the bankruptcy court found and the district court similarly found and adopted that, and this is Joint Appendix 1039, paragraph 4, bankruptcy court order, and district court order, Joint Appendix 1637, paragraph 4.
Let me ask you this about the bankruptcy order, and I'm looking at Joint Appendix 1045. In the first paragraph, the evidence does not support any finding of fraud, bad faith, mistake, or anything of a similar nature with regard to debtor and Pfister's ownership of the property. Then this sentence, the property was placed in and remained titled in both of their names intentionally. That doesn't have any bearing whatsoever on a resulting trust, does it? Because isn't in every resulting trust the property is placed in the other title holder's name intentionally? I'm just asking you, isn't that as a legal matter? Isn't that correct?
Well, as a legal matter, Your Honor, in
the fact that the property, I'm just focusing on this one sentence, the property was placed in and remained titled in both of their names intentionally, correct. That doesn't add anything to our discussion or conclusion as to whether or not there should or should not be a resulting trust, right?
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that statement.
Then explain it why it has any bearing.
Well, while that is, the court notes that the property was placed in, that's of particular importance, was placed in both of their names intentionally.
Right.
That goes to the party's intent. You know,
no, it doesn't. It goes to placing it in their names. And isn't that what happens and under the resulting trust in South Carolina when property is purchased by one party but deeded in the name of another? That's all done intentionally, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor,
I'm asking this very, don't go back to the same answer. I'm asking a very specific question. The fact that the property was deeded in the name of someone else in no way defeats the theory of a resulting trust, does it? Just the fact that it was placed in their name intentionally?
Well,
otherwise, resulting trust only happened when somebody mistakenly puts the property in somebody else's name.
But, Your Honor, I think that what I'm trying to convey and perhaps
I know,
I'm not
but
doing
I'm trying
so,
to get
so very
you to
clearly.
Answer. I'm trying to get you to answer my question.
Well, I think I think that has importance, and the bankruptcy court didn't go further to apply the facts that it found in that case, but it was intentionally tied.
Since you can't answer that, let's go to the next sentence.
Okay.
All parties knew that the loans were made to defendant and secured by the property. It was, the next sentence too, it was no secret or mistake that the defendant paid the mortgages and improved the property. You agree with all that, don't you?
I do, yes, Your Honor.
Then the next sentence, her entire legal justification is, there is no justification for a resulting trust. When I read that, I thought she meant a resulting trust somehow in favor of the debtor. Doesn't that language, doesn't that seem odd? What does it mean? That the information before that all parties knew the defendant made the loans and paid the mortgages, why would it...
Well,
why wouldn't that be evidence, at least to be considered? Why is that no justification? How do I understand that sentence? There is no justification for a resulting trust. Does that sentence have anything to do with the previous two sentences?
Well, I think it just goes to show that, so there were, this property was remortgaged five or six times, and I think what the bankruptcy court is trying to get to there is that the fact that they had the opportunity each time the between 2001 and 2004 when that property was remortgaged to change ownership, and that never happened, it intentionally remained in their names. That would have been another instance where I think that a resulting trust could have arisen perhaps with each time that a new subsequent transaction occurred. But you can't look at, you know, as to the purchase date, May 10 of 2001, Laracy v. Laracy provides that subsequent transactions, changes of intent or circumstances cannot be evaluated for
right.
Imposing a result.
I've interrupted your argument with a lot of questions. I'll let you make your argument. Whatever, anything else you wanted to make. But thank you for answering my questions.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge Shedd. That I'd also like to note that the district court erred for three reasons in imposing a resulting trust in this case. That, and I've, to the extent I don't reach all these reasons in the rest of my arguments, I'll rely on my briefs and on my rebuttal to address them. That the district court assessed the party's intent before and after May 10, 2001, which, as I said, under Laracy versus Laracy, under South Carolina
can't
law.
Can't that be evidence, though? Can't actions before and after be evidence of the intent on a given date?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
Not in this case?
Correct. On January 19th.
I'm asking you as a general principle, can't behavior before and after, can it sometimes be used as evidence of intent?
I would agree that it can. Okay. In this particular,
you just don't want to use here.
Well, in this particular case, the facts do not, in the record, do not indicate that that's necessarily what you're surmising is the case. January 19, 2001, there's a executory contract for sale in the name of Architectural Glass, and there was also a plat April 11, 2001
that was
in the name.
That was all replaced by a contract signed by the debtor, right?
Correct. Well, I don't know if there was a contract signed by the debtor in the record.
Did she ever sign a contract on this property?
A contract for sale?
Any kind of contract.
Well, they signed the deed, Your Honor.
Is that a contract?
It's a record of title. And yes, there was $10 consideration exchanged in that scenario.
A deed is a contract?
In this deed. Well, there was title. There was a conveyance of title for $10.
Let me ask you again. Did she ever sign any contract on this property at all?
Apart from the deed, no, Your Honor. Well, there were contracts signed on this. Actually, there were mortgages because the title was in her name. So each mortgage that was taken out from 2001 to 2000.
There were several mortgages, weren't there?
There were. There's one after the property was transferred, which is how the bankruptcy court properly assessed the value of the debtor's interest in the property.
If you say her intent, whose intent is to be judged at the date of the purchase?
Well, under Laracy, which is a 1913 case, it's the payor's intent, but it's actually...
Sorry?
Under Laracy versus Laracy, Judge Motz, in 1913, it's the payor's intent that has to be judged. But there are later cases, in Ray Prince, for instance, that say it's the actual intent of the parties collectively. So it's the parties that you would need to assess. It's their intent on the purchase.
All right, let's talk about that. Let's just say first, if it's the intent of the purchaser, then we would look at the intent of Architectural Glass. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And if we were to look at her, and is there any indication in the record anywhere, direct evidence, that the company did anything other than they planned to own it the whole time? They did everything indicative of that. They paid all the bills. They paid the mortgage. They did all of that, correct?
Correct.
Did she contribute at all herself to any payments of any bill or any decisions about the property?
There's one instance where there's a $1,000 repayment from Architectural Glass to the appellee as a reimbursement. But there's no instance.
Was that the $1,300 payment or not so?
That's the $1,000 payment.
$1,000 or $1,300? Because there was a draw, too, now made payable to her.
Correct.
Is that the same thing?
There were several draws. It may be.
But she never paid out of her own pocket and was not reimbursed.
I don't believe there's evidence to that effect.
And what is the evidence on why she signed the deed that you are hanging your hat on? What's the evidence of why she said she signed that deed, or why anybody said she signed it?
Well, it was her testimony at trial on February 14th of 2012 that the property was intended for tax purposes.
I said why she signed the deed.
Why she signed the deed.
Right. In the testimony, she did it because her husband told her to do it. Isn't that the testimony?
The testimony is...
Is that not the testimony?
Well, that, to an effect, that is the testimony, Your Honor. Okay. But I see my time's expired. If I may just quickly wrap up that one point that I was making as to the party's intent and the district court's error, that the district court relied on the plat of April 11, 2001 and on the subsequent improvements in the loans, those seven subsequent mortgages that... Judge King addressed, and
when you say the district court, you mean the bankruptcy court?
No, I mean the district court, Judge Motz. In assessing that a resulting trust should be imposed, it impermissibly looked at prior to the purchase date and after the purchase date.
It looked at evidence it shouldn't have looked at,
in your view.
Okay, well, the district court did.
That's correct, Judge King.
I don't know that you've had a chance. You keep sort of echoing case names and the end of your argument, the conclusion. But what are the facts that best support your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The facts that best support the argument are that on the purchase date, the intent of the parties changed from what it had been prior to, such that the parties, in effect, could receive better tax treatment than would have been otherwise received if it was owned, if the property at issue was owned in Architectural Glass's name.
And I guess implicit in what you're saying, and in directly contrary to what seems to be questions coming to you from the court, is that this change in tax, this tax advantage had to go along and be with an ownership change.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. The tax advantages that were intended at that time would not have occurred, and whether they did in fact occur or not is immaterial, as the bankruptcy court noted, because it's
a
substitute.
But they couldn't have occurred without a change in who owned it.
That's correct, yes, Your Honor.
And where do we know that from?
Well, it was...
Where do we know that? That title alone might not afford tax advantages.
Well,
where is that in the record?
It was the impetus for the parties to change their intent.
What the CPA advised them to do.
Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the underlying question is, did the CPA just say you have to change this title and you don't need to really change ownership? Is there any evidence about that?
Well, looking at the record and looking at the testimony, Mr. Pfister's affidavit, what Mr. Pfister says and what the debtor corroborates is that but for a change in title, those tax advantages would not have occurred.
So when we've been talking to you about pieces of the record before, it was testimony, but now you're relying on this affidavit, right?
Well,
I thought he testified at the hearing.
And that corroborates Mr. Pfister's.
Well, where's the affidavit? The affidavit was introduced into evidence?
It was not, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the affidavit got to do with it?
It just simply corroborates it was not entered into evidence.
If somebody testified, you use what they say, don't you?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what Judge Shedd keeps saying to you is that all the CPA said was to put title in your name, and that isn't all she wrote here. So are we just supposed to know that as a matter of law, that you need to actually own the property in order to get the tax benefit, that you can't have a naked title?
Well, I don't think that's a necessary determination
in this case.
Okay,
so why isn't it?
Well,
what is the evidence that you wanted to actually do more than transfer a naked title?
Can I say this, too? I want to make it clear. I'm not suggesting that it's not in the record. I'm asking you, is it in the record?
Right.
I didn't find it in the record. I'm not saying that it's not in the record. I just don't see it in the record. I want to make that clear.
Right. If Judge Shedd, you're asking if we have anything in the record with Mr. Pfister's CPA saying
anything other than a change, anything in the record to indicate a change in title necessarily meant a change in ownership?
The record, other than the debtor and her husband's testimony, does not reflect that.
Okay, but let's go to the debtor's and her husband's testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
And where in that does it say that the ownership is changing? I'm not sure that this is right, that title can, that is here is not enough, but you seem to me to say that the record says more than maybe it does say.
Okay, I will point to Joint Appendix 1354 and the line 9. The testimony of Mrs. Pfister is that, okay, but at that point in time for tax, or the question rather is, okay, but at that point in time for tax, you testified, your testimony is for tax advantages. The decision was made to put the names in, the deed in the individual's names, correct? Okay, and so that is testimony there that goes to say that I believe what you're asking for, why was the property titled as it was? And there's another instance.
Okay. I just want to be sure you understand what it is that is at issue. The suggestion is made that just putting it, the CPA might have just said, put it in your name, but you're not going to be transferring ownership.
Right. There's no testimony in the record from trial to that effect, Your Honor.
But is there testimony that you're doing, when you're putting in your name, you are transferring ownership? Or not maybe in those words, but implicitly. And you're saying the decision was named to put the names in, the deed in the individual's name. Now, maybe that does do it, right? Correct. And then what else do you have to offer to us?
Well, in just further testimony to that effect, I would also point you to Joint Appendix, page 1261.
1251?
1261, Your Honor.
And who's that?
That is the debtor on cross-examination.
What did she say?
The question was, why was the court, why did you put your name on the deed? Why was it individually your name and your husband's name? And the answer was, I believe our CPA at the time recommended it for tax reasons.
I did it for tax reasons?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district judge, or the bankruptcy judge, finding on that is laid out at number 4 of the findings of fact on 1039. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
She said, based on the advice of their accountant, the property was titled and owned in debtor's and Pfister's individual names. Pfister testified that he and debtor were advised that defendant could pay rent for use of the property, and debtor and Pfister could receive tax advantages from this arrangement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's a finding.
Is that supported by the record?
That is supported, I believe, to the extent I understand your question, I believe that's supported by the testimony.
That's a simple question. Is that supported by the record, it's a yes or no. If it's not supported by the record, then if it's clear error, the underpinnings of your case fall away.
I understand, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that's what it comes down to. Maybe there's something else that's involved here, but that's pretty much what it comes down to.
That's really what's at issue, Your Honor, and that's what my brief speaks to.
Finding of fact number 4 is supported by the record, and whether it survives clear error review.
Yes, Judge King.
And the only evidence in that finding for own is the title.
The title and the testimony to the effect that title was changed from the previous intention.
Did that have to do anything with ownership? I'm just asking.
Well, you also have on 1353, Mr. Pfister, tell the court what reason did you come to put this deed in the name of the individual names for you and your wife? The CPA instructed me that would be in my interest for tax purposes. So, and in the other page, we also have deed. And deed often, usually, reflects ownership.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree, and that's the trustee's position in this case.
I looked at page 1261 you had us look at. That's a cross-examination of the debtor, is it?
Yeah.
That's what he said, yeah.
Is that correct? I'm looking at line 18. Whose property did you consider this to be? And she says architectural glass.
That's correct.
Is there not evidence of what she thought?
Well, Your Honor, the bankruptcy court heard this testimony. It weighed the evidence and questioned her credibility. And
when did she question that? I thought she believed everything she said.
I think, didn't she say that this is evidence of after the fact?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before or after, but not at the date when.
That's correct. This is later self-serving testimony. If you look at Joint Appendix, page 1562, Your Honor.
1562?
Correct, Judge Dean. The court noted that, but I had a little bit of credibility problem when her testimony, the debtor.
He said she had a credibility problem?
Yes, Judge King. But I had a little bit of a credibility problem when her testimony conflicted with things that are written in the schedules and when she didn't have a lot of memory of things that happened.
Okay.
So the bankruptcy court properly weighed the evidence and assessed the credibility of the witnesses in this case, and this trustee's position that it would be clear error not to uphold those findings of facts, and the findings of facts that were duly noted by the district court in adopting the findings of facts.
Did the district court specifically say that finding of fact number 4 was clearly erroneous?
It did not, Your Honor. It actually adopted finding of fact number 4.
It adopted finding of fact number 4.
Well, it adopted findings of facts 1 through 14 but not the entirety of the facts. I believe the findings of the facts of the bankruptcy court.
But it didn't say, my question was, did it find finding of fact number four to be clear error? And you say it did not.
It did not. That's okay. Correct, Your Honor.
And I thought you just said it adopted it. It adopted 1 through 14.
That's correct. And if it...
All right.
Well, Judge Motz, if the court had found number four clear error, it would not have adopted
1 through 14.
Correct.
Right.
Right. We got that.
My apologies, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Time has expired.
Yes, ma'am.
Where is the initial note?
Ma'am?
Where is the initial note?
The initial note? The notes were not made a part of the record. I mean, the notes were not presented at trial, Your Honor.
Well, if the note's not in evidence, how can you prevail under a clear and convincing standard?
No, clear. Well, there was testimony, Your Honor. There was testimony from Greg Sis, Vice President at Greer State Bank at the time of the trial. However, he was the lender bank. Employee at the bank that Mr. Pfister dealt with originally on the original loan to BB&T, that was 100% financed, that purchased this piece of property on Highway 101 in Greer, South Carolina. That property at that time was completely undeveloped. Mr. Pfister...
You know, I'm sure that's all interesting, but what I'm mostly interested in is what the note says, and the best evidence of what the note says is the note.
Yes, ma'am. But however, the testimony of Greg Sisk at the time said the original note to BB&T was put in the name of Architectural Glass. Architectural Glass was solely responsible for the debt on this property. Architectural Glass made every payment on the original note to BB&T. That testimony is on Joint Appendix 1361 through 1362.
Is there any evidence in this record who actually paid the money to buy the property?
Yes, sir. It was the defendant, Architectural Glass.
Where is that? You sure that evidence is in there?
I don't think so.
I never saw it.
That evidence was in by the testimony of Mr. Pfister.
He said I took money and bought the property. Is that what he said?
He approached BB&T.
Right, he did that, but you sure this testimony? Let me say this, and we can move on. I never saw any testimony about who actually purchased the property.
Yes, there was testimony from Mr. Pfister that the corporation paid every mortgage and every note, every...
But you know what, but that doesn't necessarily mean it. Couldn't he have bought property, say, for instance, personally, paid the money out of his pocket, and so this is not a purchase money mortgage, but then they take out a mortgage and pay him back? I mean, just because you have a mortgage on the property or a note on the property and it's paid, it didn't necessarily tell you who purchased the property in the first instance.
Yes.
Does it?
Yeah. Yes, sir, Your Honor. Through the testimony, there was everything that was testified to, the documents that were entered into evidence, which there was a general transaction ledger from Architectural Glass Construction, Inc., who had their own separate checking account, own separate account. That general ledger detailed payments to, and you can track it, and that's what was entered into evidence, and there was no dispute as to that, was the payments to BB&T on the original.
You're missing the point, though. Making note payments is not the same as, is there a ledger entry saying pay, who owned the property before the purchase? Who owned it? Who owned the property? Who did they buy the property from?
They bought the property from...
Do you know?
It was a corporate, not off the top. It was a...
Is there any ledger entry showing Architectural Glass writing a check to them for the purchase price?
No, sir, Jan. It was 100%. It was a loan. It was a note financed from BB&T, 100% financed.
Does the record indicate that was a purchase money mortgage or note? Doesn't indicate. I couldn't find that.
No, sir, we don't have a note.
Yeah. Even if you don't have the note, is there any testimony about that?
There was testimony that the appellate corporation paid all.
What is the testimony in this record about what Ms. Pfister knew or did about this property, or her role in acquiring it, paying for it, or anything? What did she have to do with this property?
Mr. Feaster, Ms. Feaster had nothing to do with this property, Your Honor. And in fact, the only
thing... she had it deeded in her name.
She had it deeded in her
name.
Except
according to the bankruptcy judge, she owned it.
That was...
Finding of fact number four says that was adopted by the district judge, says she owned it. Now, yes. What did she have to do with it?
Your Honor, she had nothing to do with it.
Well, what do you do about finding of fact number four?
Your Honor, if...
The property was titled and owned in debtors and Fister's individual names. And that finding of fact was adopted by the district court.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
So, but how's your answer anything other than the fact she owned it?
Well, the fact of that...
You have to say that the bankruptcy court erred.
Yes.
And the district court erred.
Yes, so the bankruptcy court erred, John. We believe that the district court did not err and were correct in the findings
of
fact.
Well, what did it mean when it adopted the finding of fact?
Yes, when they did adopt the findings of fact on the bankruptcy court. Now, the bankrupt and the findings of fact pretty much, now that, and it comes down to title and own. Again, as the court had noted earlier in opposing the trustee's argument, there was nothing in the record. It dealt with title. There was nothing in the record, any testimony as to ownership of the property. It was you titled this property in this manner for tax advantages.
If she had owned it on that day by way of title, would that change your argument?
If
title is indicative of ownership on the date that the property was deeded, does that change your argument? You don't understand
the question. If you could ask that again, Your Honor, I would.
Could a person own property and still there be a resulting trust in favor of another person under South Carolina law?
They hold it in trust, Your Honor. They have a bare legal title. They're the owner of is.
I mean, under South Carolina law, is title indicative of ownership?
No, sir.
You sure about that? I'm just asking. You sure about that? Yes. I'm just wondering. I was asking the questions because I couldn't find any evidence that she had any ownership function or rights other than mere title.
Yes.
But it could be that the courts, first of all, the district court's decision is entirely inconsistent with accepting full ownership, no resulting trust. You can't read the district court decision any differently than that, can you? He said, I know what the bankruptcy court found, but there is a resulting trust under these facts, correct?
Yes, yes.
And so I'm asking you now, does the fact there might be ownership in Party A necessarily defeat a resulting trust in favor of Party B?
No, sir, Your Honor.
But no, who has the burden of proving? You do, by clear and convincing evidence.
Yes, yes, yeah. Ma'am.
Well, there you go.
Except that isn't there, if one person purchases the property and is deeded to another, doesn't that raise the presumption of a resulting trust?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So what do we do with that? Or you just kind of because you don't understand because it looked, from everything you can tell, the company bought this, they prepared the plat for the company, they prepared the plat for the property, they contracted for the property, they paid for the property, it's their property, and everybody knew it, and that's why you were kind of stunned that somehow people think it's not your property. Is that the point?
Well, you know, sir, Your Honor, again, it
is not the point.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. But it goes...
We look at all this on the date of acquisition, don't we?
On the date of acquisition, the intent of the... Yes, but you look at the intent of the defendant corporation...
No, everything, the date of acquisition. Did AGC pay any money on the date of acquisition?
It was 100% of the note was...
I thought that the evidence was undisputed, that it didn't pay anything until afterwards.
Well, there was nothing put down on the property. No, ma'am, nothing was put down. It was
the thing. So we have title in the individuals and no money paid out by you on the day of acquisition, and we're looking at intent on the day of acquisition.
Are you saying that there was no money paid out on the date of acquisition?
Now,
it's a question of whether or not the record reflects that. By the way, where do you get property and you don't pay for it? I want to get in one of those closings myself.
BB&T paid all the money.
BB&T paid
the money. BB&T cut a check consistent with financing the property.
Yes, sir. That was in the name of Architectural Glass Construction, Inc. That Architectural Glass paid for every penny on the. They paid every payment on that.
It was titled in the name of the debtor and her husband, wasn't it?
The title was in the debtor and her husband for tax advantages.
So the loan was made to the debtor and her husband.
No, sir. The loan was made to Architectural Glass Construction Incorporated.
In the argument here that every loan, that initial loan and every subsequent loan, the note itself, is always made to Architectural Glass.
Yes, that's correct.
But since the property had been titled in the woman's name, she also had to be on the mortgage.
That's right.
Because you had to have that property owned, the argument is, owned by Architectural Glass, but yet titled for other reasons not to do with real ownership in her name. She always had to sign the mortgage as well.
That's right, Your Honor. She effectively just had to show up. All she did in regards to this property was if there was a closing, there was a mortgage, her husband told her to come down to the mortgage, to the attorney's office, and she just showed up. That's all she did. She didn't have anything to do. She wasn't a guarantor on those notes. She didn't make any payments toward the notes. She wasn't a member. She wasn't an employee of the corporation.
Isn't it pretty clear that she just showed up and honestly just did what her husband said? No offense. She just said, I think he said, I told her to sign the deed.
Yeah.
Her testimony really is. She didn't testify at trial, did she?
Yes.
She did? I thought it was deposition testimony. But she just goes, I didn't really know anything about it. I just sort of did what I was told on it.
Yes. Yes, sir, Your Honor. And that was it. Mr. Pfister was...
What you're saying is 180 degrees from what the bankruptcy court found, right?
Yes, sir.
And it's 180 degrees from what the district court found.
Yeah, well, yes,
so,
sir. Yeah.
So... For us to agree with you, we got a fine. That what you're saying is the fact.
Well, no, sir, Your Honor, I think the facts.
We know what business we got to do finding facts.
Is it 180 degrees different if the bankruptcy court took title to mean ownership? Did the bankruptcy court or the district court draw any distinction whatsoever between title and ownership in their findings?
The district court, Your Honor?
Either of them. I ask you, either of them.
Well, I think, and Your Honor, again, the facts were reviewed for clear error, the decisions of law de novo. I believe in the bankruptcy court, I believe the...
We review this thing de novo.
Yes, sir.
So, and we review what the district court did de novo, we review what the bankruptcy court did de novo, but we defer to the bankruptcy court on its findings of fact and review those for clear error. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would say again that
so you got to convince us that the
testimony,
paragraph 4 of the findings of fact is wrong.
Yes, sir. In the testimony paragraph.
Don't you have to do that?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And Your Honor, I would note that the findings of fact in paragraph 4 of the bankruptcy judgment, it said title and own, that is clear error because there's no evidence in the record that there was any ownership interest discussed or transferred when they went to the CPA, and the CPA said for tax advantages or tax purposes, maybe better to be titled in this name, in the individual's name.
I'm going to ask you this question one more time. Does ownership by Party A necessarily defeat a resulting trust to Party B under South Carolina law? I don't know the answer for sure, but I suspect I know what it is. Does it?
No, sir.
The problem you have is, you're being asked questions about the fact that two courts appear to have said that Pfister owned the property, owned it. And so the question is, if she owned it, could there still be a resulting trust?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. I think you...
Did the district court think that?
Yes, sir.
Because the district court, if the district court did find... She owned it. The district court didn't find that ownership, find the fact or not, change the conclusion of law, did it? Because they didn't the district court find a resulting trust?
Yes. They also found, pursuant to 541D, that when you look at legal and equitable interest, that the equitable owner of this property was Architectural Glass Inc. Now, she may have owned, she had bare legal title, the debtor had bare legal title, which in accordance with the Mid-Atlantic case and other cases, that had no value.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
I take your position to be bare legal title, but if we assume that the courts were correct and she owned it, she didn't have bare legal title, she owned it, she had any kind of title you want to do, she had enough title to get tax advantages because of it, then do you lose? You have to go with bare legal title. Is that right? Is that your position?
Well, that's, yes, ma'am, that's been our position this whole,
if contrary to your position, she actually did own the property, then you would recognize that you lose. Is that right? If she had just bare legal title, you think you win.
Yes, but if she did own the property, then you go to legal and equitable interest. Under the bankruptcy code, legal ownership, what was her equitable interest? She doesn't, her equitable interest that is not hers does not go into the bankruptcy estate.
How do you prove that she had to defeat her legal title? How do you prove, what do you have to introduce to defeat that interest?
Well, I believe the value of what was transferred is always on, pursuant to 548, is always on the trustee. But, however, in this case, as the district court noted, you gained equity by payment of a purchase price, paying down the mortgage, in this case, improving the property, making improvements.
I thought that you had to look at the time of the transfer. You have some law that says you don't. You look at subsequent evidence.
You look, and I think in the Decoy versus Decoy, they looked, in that case, it dealt with a resulting trust, and they talked about the mother-in-law's titling the name and her daughter-in-law to...
Isn't there some question that a resulting trust, notwithstanding any determination on the date of the deed, it can result, say, from appreciation of property value or some other factor that changes the property? Isn't that what the law is cited as?
Yes.
But you were making an argument about whether or not she had ownership, whether or not, I took it to be, whether or not there's a resulting trust. Her equitable interest, even if she had legal title on some other theory, her equitable interest is zero anyway.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
Is that an argument that even if there isn't a result, even if you lose on the resulting trust issue, and the court were to say she owned the property because of her title to defeat the resulting trust, you then look at what is her ownership interest worth?
Yes.
And you say it's worth zero.
Yes. Or it was not. What was her undivided? The debtor was supposed to transfer as an undivided one-half interest. What is that? I don't think the bankruptcy court really knew what that was, or whether that was proven at trial. Because the fact of the matter is, from day one, the debtor again.
But is this argument completely separate than the resulting trust argument?
I think there's two arguments. I believe there was.
Well, so that would mean it's completely separate from the resulting trust argument.
I think once you've an equitable ownership, I mean, obviously the district court imposed a resulting trust on behalf of the corporation because they were the equitable owner or had an equitable owner of the property on Highway 101, and I think that's clear. I think there was no other evidence in the record that the debtor had any contribution.
Stop for a second. Listen to me very carefully.
Yes.
If you lose on the question of resulting trust, do you think you still can win that the debtor is entitled to zero value from that property?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because she, from day one, the debtor had no, she made no payments on those, on that.
Well, no, that's factual. Your legal argument is she had no, she had zero equitable interest.
Yes.
So her equitable interest there was valued at zero.
That's right. Her legal title to the property was bare legal title, which is zero. The equitable interest in that, the equitable interest lied with the appellant corporation. It for instance, when this property was bought for $74,000, at the date of 2008, the date of transfer, it was worth $470,000. Mr. Bruce Owens testified The reason for that increase in value was mainly from the result of the active conduct, the actions of Architectural Glass Construction, Inc. So it was the corporation that improved the property, made all the payments on the mortgage and the loans. I don't think that's disputed. Nobody disputes that. Bankruptcy judge didn't dispute that, and nor did the district.
Is the finding, okay, I want to go back to the resulting trust. Is the finding of intent, is that a legal or a factual question?
I think it's mixed, Your Honor.
Okay. Didn't the district court find, the actual intent of the parties was that the property was Architectural Glass's, to be used solely by Architectural Glass?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Okay.
What do we do with that in light of the factual finding that the property was titled and owned by Pfister? Can you reconcile those two?
I think it's because the review is de novo. That's
how do you reconcile them, I said? How do you reconcile what looks like a factual finding that Pfister owned the property and that it was the intent of the parties that the property be solely by Architectural Glass? How do you reconcile those two?
You reconcile those two, Your Honor, it's a mixed question. It's a matter of law, resulting trust, the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties, I believe, from day one was that Architectural Glass was the true owner of this property.
Who makes the factual findings in this case? There are three courts in it so far: bankruptcy court, district court, and appellate court.
Yes.
Do appellate courts make factual findings in bankruptcy cases?
No, sir, Your Honor.
The district court makes factual findings in bankruptcy cases?
They review, no, sir. They review.
So the factual findings are made by the bankruptcy court?
Yes, sir.
And here it was after a trial?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And we defer to those factual findings, the appellate courts do, to the extent that we review them for clear error only.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's my understanding of the law, too.
But the factual finding of the ownership is not inconsistent with the district court's legal conclusion of the intent that the property be Architectural Glass, is it?
No, sir. That is, would note that, that number four, the title and ownership, again, title was discussed at the trial. Ownership, the actual ownership was not any testimony in the record to that effect. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, just a few issues to clarify. First, that the intent that must be assessed is that of the purchase date. And critically, I think something to consider is that also the intent on the purchase date was that that the debtor would receive benefits that are commensurate with ownership. She intended to receive rent from the corporation. So it's not just that she intended to have it titled in her name, but she had an intent.
What do you
benefits.
Do with the fact that the district court found it was the actual legal intent of the parties for the property to be used solely by Architectural Glass? What do you do with that finding?
With that finding, Your Honor, I think that South Carolina resulting trust jurisprudence requires that you look not at the use, but that you look at intent as to ownership. And it was always the intent that the appellee would use the property. It was always the intent that Architectural Glass would use the property.
But it would pay rent.
Correct.
To the owners.
Yes, yes,
and
Judge
you're
Wise.
Saying the rent is evidence of ownership. The fact that you're going to take the tax advantage isn't evidence of ownership.
Yes, Your Honor. So there was a benefit that the debtor intended to receive on the purchase date that's commensurate with her intent of ownership.
So what was it? Was it a gift from Architectural Glass to her?
Your Honor, I would also argue that, correct, the gift presumption, which is a competing presumption,
so it was a gift.
Resulting trust could apply. Well, in effect, a gift applies in South Carolina law when you have, for instance, in this case, husband to wife transfer.
Is your position that it was a gift to her from Architectural Glass?
We make that argument, Your Honor. The trustee makes that argument. And that, so a gift arises.
So she didn't acquire it by purchase. She acquired it as a gift.
Well, she didn't pay the purchase price, if that's what.
She didn't acquire by purchase, did she? by her purchase of it.
Correct, Your Honor.
You don't make that claim, do you?
I do not, Your Honor.
You don't claim that she bought the property.
That's not the claim, Your Honor. It was the intent of the property. It was,
no,
it was the intent of the parties.
Answer my question. You don't claim she bought the property.
I do not.
But you, so your theory then is it was a gift to her?
Well, that's one analysis to look
what
at.
What else is it then? Stumbled upon it?
No, the other, Your Honor, is that we rebut by definite, clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence the imposition of resulting trust in this case.
I didn't ask you that, though, but I said how she got it. The resulting trust is how she loses it. I said, how did she get it on the day she acquired title? She didn't pay. You just said, and I think you're right, nothing in this record suggests she in any way purchased it. Correct. So it was a gift to her?
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, that correct, that it can be seen as a gift as
what
well.
Can it be
does
seen?
A gift give you tax advantages? If she receives a gift, how does that work into the tax advantages that she says she was getting based on what the CPA said?
I'm not entirely certain, Your Honor, how
well,
that
I
would.
I bet you're not.
How that would play in.
Is your theory built on the fact that this was a gift to her?
It's not built on. Yeah, I think that's another argument that what, when you assess the facts.
Listen, tell me your theory of this case. How did she acquire ownership?
She acquires ownership by taking title.
Right. And how did she take title? What did she do to get that title? She didn't pay for it at all, right?
Correct.
I've thought of gift. Is there another way you can get it? I mean, there might be. You don't make another claim. Your claim is she didn't pay for it, but she got it. So what? Therefore, it was a gift to her?
It could very well be. But on the intent, on the purchase date, the party is intended, Your Honor, that...
Well, she signed the mortgage, didn't she?
She did sign all the mortgages. That's correct.
She signed the mortgage. So she promised to pay the mortgage.
That's right. And she let the appellee use the property, and she promised to pay the mortgages.
I mean, that's a finding of fact there, too. I mean, number three says the loan was secured by a mortgage.
Yes, sir.
Signed by the debtor
and her husband.
Well, isn't there evidence in this record that the husband owns the corporation, AP, whatever it is, AGC?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't think there's any mystery about this.
The argument that I would like to make, if you allow me just a moment, is that under South Carolina law, a gift arises, which is a competing presumption to resulting trust when you have a transfer and the property is paid for by a spouse, conveyance is taken in another spouse's name. The trustee would argue that in this case it's similar to Windsor Properties versus Dolphin Head Construction Company, that where a husband's wholly owned company transfer.
Whatever you get there, your theory of this case is this is a gift to her. Arising by presumption otherwise, your theory to this court is it was a gift to her.
Well, I think there are two distinct theories.
Yeah, yes or no?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, how did she get it then? She didn't purchase it. She did, in fact, sign a mortgage to secure the note, which is the promise of paying, isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay. But she didn't sign that until after she acquired the property, right?
Correct.
Well, how did she acquire the property, though?
She acquired the property. And what's important for resulting trust?
I know she was deeded the property, but I mean,
right.
You either pay for property or it's gifted to you. How else do you get it?
Well, in this case, I think I'm misunderstanding your question here. And what I'm trying to convey is that...
Let me make it clear. How did she acquire the property? Let me ask you, one, did she purchase it in any way whatsoever?
No, she did not, Your Honor.
Okay, now the next question is, then how did she acquire it? Was it by gift?
It was by rebutting the presumption of a resulting
that
trust.
That doesn't rebut anything. That just, that didn't tell how she gets it. That just prevents her from keeping what she has.
Correct. I guess not necessarily assessing the exact legalities of the elements to impose a gift and to rebut the resulting trust. Correct.
Get it.
Right. And so in that vein, she didn't pay a purchase price, but the intent on the date was that she would receive ownership benefits you could argue
gift?
It's a gift. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not arguing anything. Do you argue it's anything other than a gift?
Well, she didn't. If we're defining gift as payment of purchase price,
I asked
or
you
as not paying purchase
price.
I
asked you, are you arguing that she had obtained it any way other than a gift?
The facts of the matter are that in the record, she didn't pay the mortgage price, so therefore you could argue that it was a gift to, and you can, the trustee will say.
Let me ask you what I could argue.
Yes, Your Honor.
What you argue.
Yes, Your Honor. It was, so if.
Just listen, let's just start again. Tell me, don't talk to me about the intent at the time of the date. This is a separate question. Tell me your theory of this case. How is it that she came to own it on that day? But what did she do to own it? Did she do something actively to get it, or did somebody just gift it to her, or is there another alternative that I'm not thinking about?
No, she, Your Honor, she met with her, the record indicates she met with the CPA along with her husband, and that was...
It has nothing to do with how she got, I'm just talking about how...
Right, and so, therefore, by, and...
Who signed the note?
The note was signed by Architectural Glass. It was personally guaranteed by Mr. Pfister.
She never signed the note as a guarantee or as the note itself, did she?
Correct, Judge.
Now, why is that not in the record?
It, well, Your Honor, there's testimony to that effect by the debtor's husband in the record.
But you don't dispute that, do you?
I do not dispute that. And if a gift is imposed, I might add that the burden shifts to the appellee to rebut the gift presumption by definite, clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence under Legendre versus South Carolina Tax Commission. A few just more points to make here. The deed is not a contract for sale, Your Honor. Judge Shedd, it's record of your title.
You trying to convince me of that? That's why I was asking you the one that said it was a contract.
I understand. I just want to clarify that.
Sure, I got you.
And also that the trustee withdraws two arguments in this case that I meant to withdraw earlier but do not have any bearing on your resulting trust analysis. That we withdraw just simply that the creditors relied on debtor's ownership.
Did you? I'm not looking at your brief now. Did you make the argument that the district court is wrong, necessarily wrong, because the finding of fact that Ms. Pfister owned the property on that day necessarily means the district court could not find a resulting trust?
I did make that argument
in
my brief, Your Honor.
That is just, it's just, your argument is it's legally impossible for a resulting trust, legally impossible as a matter of law, for a resulting trust to be imposed on a piece of property that someone else owns.
No, but the finding wasn't just owns.
Right. My argument is that if there's no resulting trust imposed in this case to bifurcate title, the two are in ownership and splitting title by virtue of trust. Those two are inextricably linked. You have to have a trust to bifurcate the debtor's interest in this property. And so far as resulting trust is not warranted in this case, there is no way in which Architectural Glass can hold any equitable interest in the property.
It's on 1039. Based on advice of their accountant, the property was titled and owned in debtor's and Pfister's individual names. Pfister testified that he and debtor were advised that defendant could pay rent for use of the property, and debtor and Pfister could receive tax advantages from this arrangement.
But I'm still asking the question, is it your position that a resulting trust as a matter of law cannot result from a situation where another party owns the property? That can't be the law, can it?
If it's rebutted by the party's action.
I didn't ask anything about rebutted. I said as a matter of law.
The whole thing about resulting trust is it can be rebutted if you have this bare ownership. But what your position is that hasn't been rebutted here, isn't it?
Yes. Well, Your Honor, the position that we take is that we have rebutted the resulting trust.
Yeah. Okay. So start me over again.
Okay. And Legendre versus South Carolina Tax Commission provides that.
Just try and stay with ordinary English. Try to explain this to an eighth grader. Go there and tell me why you
would. Yes, Your Honor. Well, resulting trust is a matter of fact and not of law. It's imposed where you have one party pay a purchase price, and for some different reason, it's titled in the name of another, rebutted by the contrary intention of the parties, must arise, if at all, at the time of conveyance. Resulting trust must arise, if at all, at the time of conveyance of the piece of land. In this case, the evidence in the record and the findings of facts were not clear error. They support the rebuttal of the resulting trust. Because a resulting trust does not exist to give equitable title to the appellee in this case, the debtor necessarily transferred to the appellee on December 31 an entire, full, undivided one-half interest in the property. She has to, the appellee must prove that there's a resulting trust in this case to have received.
Is she entitled to all the appreciation that Architectural Glass did to the property?
Well, Your Honor, the bankruptcy court found as fact that she had substantial equity. And
no, that's not what I asked. Is she entitled, and maybe the bankruptcy court found that, but the property was improved, correct?
Correct.
At the sole expense of Architectural Glass, or did they gift her with that too?
Well, the majority of the consideration was actually paid by the banks, to which Architectural Glass became liable on the commercial promissory notes that it issued. It didn't
pay down. Really making that, or you're not really making that. That's the old saw that if you have a mortgage, you don't own your house, the bank owns it. You're not making that argument, are you?
I thought there actually was evidence here that it had been not appreciation, but mostly just use of the loans and then paying back the loans.
Yes, Judge Moss.
Buildings were put on that property, weren't they?
I'm sorry?
Buildings were put on this property.
They were two buildings, yes, sir, showroom.
After the purchase date.
Correct.
But they borrowed money to build the building.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I thought there was evidence somewhere that the buildings weren't worth much more than the loans taken out to pay them.
How much is the property worth now? Or when you were in front of the bankruptcy court, how much was it worth?
Well, when we were in front of the bankruptcy court, the value declined, and I wasn't.
How much was it worth?
It was. I can't tell you exactly how much it was worth at that point in time. In 2011, it was.
They're saying her interest is $43,500.
I thought it was like worth $70,000.
At the time of the transfer, the property was worth $470,000. It was appraised on December 5th of 2008. The transfer occurred on December 31, 2008. So within that month, it was valued at $470,000. The mortgages outstanding on the property were in the amount of $304,000. So the equity existing in the property at the time of the transfer was $166,000. One half interest of that is $83,000. So the debtor received, the bankruptcy court awarded, in my opinion, a conservative estimate based on just simply splitting the equity, $83,000 versus the award, $43,500.
And I thought you'd said earlier that all this comes down to whether finding of fact number 4 made by the bankruptcy court was clearly erroneous, which was adopted in hac verba, word for word, rewritten in the findings of fact of the district court. Came down, everything comes down to whether that's clearly erroneous. Now, is that point that, and you said earlier that was it. Is that point at all consistent with that long answer you gave to Judge Motz about what your position is?
I think so.
Yes.
You think
it is
different or not different?
No, I think my points are consistent, Your Honor.
I think they're consistent. So still all comes down to finding of fact number 4.
It does. This is just...
All it is finding of fact number 4. That we could sum it up in 5 or 6 words.
Correct.
Finding of fact number 4, correct.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what's before us in these issues.
That's all we've got to say is 6 words. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your position. Now, Mr. Epps doesn't agree with any of it.
That's correct.
We understand that.
That's right. Thank you for your time.
Let me ask this of you. You think finding a fact adopted totally necessarily means there can't be a resulting trust? A legal determination as to intent on a legal trust? You think the finding of fact 4 necessarily, beyond all question, precludes a finding of a resulting trust?
Well, in this case...
Yes or no?
Yes, and I'll explain that in this case, the bankruptcy court got it right. The district court first found that...
Okay, I got you. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think if we keep asking questions, you're going to answer his that way.
We're going to start all over again.
Mine that way, but thank you.
Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you. We will come down and greet the lawyers, and then we'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and we'll come down and greet the lawyers.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 8:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.